This episode of Commentary, Trek Stars, is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad, and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 4, Episode 5 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike, and today is Part 5 in our series on Larry Nemechek as an author, where we are going to be continuing our discussion with Larry himself about his books. Last week, we talked about the Star Trek The Next Generation companion, as well as his episode of Voyager Prophecy. And this week we are going to talk to him about Stellar Cartography, which is his new Star Trek book. So let's just jump right back into it. Here is Max and myself interviewing Larry. All right, so Stellar Cartography.
Oh my God, we've got Stellar Cartography to do.
We can stop.
If you guys want to torture everybody, we can go ahead. Because I laid the groundwork for Stellar Cartography, in a way.
Yes. I just want to cover something here. The lesson that you learned that the pictures are what matter, is that what led you to make Stellar Cartography? Because you were like, I guess people like the pictures, let's just do that, and I'll write some notes.
No, what led me to do Stellar Cartography was John Van Sitter's going, hey, we're finally doing some nonfiction again. We're going to do a star chart. You should do it. Okay. That's what led me to do.
We'll get into it, but like I was really impressed with the text because there's so much stuff I didn't know.
Yeah, it was very surprising to. Yeah.
That was a case where, I mean, the idea was because the maps themselves. Jeff did incredible, and I want to make sure everybody gets this. The way there was, Jeff's, the 2002-2003 book, which was very cool because it was kind of like, oh, here's, Mandela Nemechek, star charting again, although it was his baby. The idea, and the way it was done was, he did it like Mike and Denise did the encyclopedia, and Doug did the encyclopedia and the chronology, as in, we're going to not just write these, but lay them out ourselves so we can have the most control, not because we're control freaks, but that way your shop guys who, and I think Pocket is burdened by having a paste up shop or eventually, digital layout people.
Yeah.
But that's why the books all look so. That's why my book, it's all column. It's I don't know if you guys go back to PageMaker, the old original PageMaker. It was kind of pour your text in, stick your pictures in, and then pour your text in two columns or three columns. That's the way I did when I would do my concordances, but this was 87, 89. It was stick your art in, and then pour your text in, and then stick your letters, the A section, the B section, the C, the D's. And then stick in your art when it needed to. I had 10 or 12 illustrations to stick in the columns to break up the pages. But it was pour that text in and just let it go through the column template. And that's basically what all the, books were. And Mike and Rick were so, Mike and Denise and Doug, with the encyclopedia especially, you have those staggered, where they follow a ship. You can have a ship bigger because it follows the outline of the ship or the thing, the prop. They did those pages themselves and they could lay them out, cram the information, and update them until the last possible second, because they're working on the show, right?
Mm-hmm.
And those were all but they held control of the pages so that then it was okay, here's the PDFs or whatever it was file. Now go and bang it and print it, And Jeff, with the book in 03, did the same thing. He did all those in, at Illustrator, I guess. And it was his deal was, I'm going to deliver this to you, ready to go. So he had the ultimate control over everything and his things. So he had last minute changes and he could tweak it and make sure that there wasn't a middleman, i.e. the traditional way of doing books. There wasn't a middleman. And it's not like he could bop down and look over the guy's shoulder or girl's shoulder, LA to New York. So the original Star Trek Star Charts book in 03 was his files and his baby, and that was based on, you know, Mike's quadrant system, and all this stuff had come along since those 1980 maps, obviously. When Mike invented the quadrant system for the price, what people didn't know, what was so cool about having the tech manuals from the third season, fourth season, before the tech manual was out in pro thing, was there was a lot more detail on the in-house one than they put in the published one. There were a lot of things they hung back on just because they knew that within a year or two, the show writers might change something or add to it. And they didn't want everybody buying the book to go, hey, this is over here, not over here. Warp 7 is this, not this. You know, it's like, yes, we know, because that was printed on hard paper in 1992, and you're looking at it 2 years later, and the show is an evolving, organic thing. You know, so some stuff they hung back on and didn't stick in the pro version, but I had it. And one of those was where the Romulans and Klingons and Cardassians were on the grid map. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's in the tech manual. I think they finally put a very basic, here's how we get the alpha, delta, gamma, beta quadrants. But I knew where they were. So as they were... for a long time, they actually tried to make, as they brought the wounded, and they're talking about the Cardassians, and they're talking about bopping around sector this. They were really trying to keep a sector number system going at the beginning. It's like the room numbers on the Enterprise with that axis, the two axes and the number of things. The first 2 or 3 years, Mike really tried to make the rooms make sense where they were supposed to be on the overall thing of the ship. And then after 3 or 4 years, even he had to kind of give up and back off of the fact that he'd ever tried to do it in the first place. Because they couldn't keep up that intensity, you know, mm-hmm. or something would have to be done in 5 seconds, and there wasn't time to sit and plot where it had to be because they had to film the same damn scene. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, we've decided right now to just throw another sticker up there. Mike, it doesn't matter. Just throw another sticker up there. It's like, I'm sorry, 14 people, anal people with their forehead VCRs are going to frame, you know, forget HD and Blu-ray coming in 20 years. Oh, my God, you know. So Jeff handed in his pages, did that, took it from the evolution of Mike's grid through what fans had done who were in the know, knowing where things were. So this whole thing of Memory Alpha and the, no one ever said the Klingons and Romulans are in the Beta Quadrant, where does that come from? The chart that we see at the end of Remick's head blowing up in Coming of Age doesn't have any, you know, that's all the Alpha, and they're hung up on this thing, where the whole, and it, so Jeff in Voyager is putting the galaxy up there with the quadrants showing the jaggedy line. And, you know, everybody, there were two major shortcuts, right? Everybody goes on Voyager. You know, when they leave the Delta Quadrant, they're not in the Alpha Quadrant because Earth-Sol is the boundary line. So they're going to, like, cross the Beta Quadrant before they get the Alpha Quadrant, unless they go, like, a big hook for some stupid reason and go way out of their way around the galactic center to come in, throw through the gamma and come into the alpha directly. But that's done. The shortest line is gamma, cut the corner of the beta, and hit Earth, if you're talking about, you know. But that was, oh, that's too complicated. We're not gonna. So they never talked about the end of Voyager cutting across the corner of the beta quadrant. Same way as in Dominion War in DS9. They never talked about the alpha beta quadrant powers. The Dominion would say, oh, we hate the alpha quadrant powers. They're not to be trusted. And people would say, see, the Klingons and Romulans can't be in the Beta Quadrant because they're the Alpha Quadrant powers. And it's like, well, that's like a shorthand, and it's the Dominion saying it, and if our people say it, it's just echoing that. And it's just, oh, and like, and Ira and Ron and Renee, they all go, we know, but if we clunk up all the dialogue, every time somebody says to say, well, you know, the Alpha, Beta, Quadrant, they just say the homeworlds, or us guys, or something. It's like, it becomes ridiculous. So that was this big argument. So one of the things which made me mad, I go, it's on canon. It's on the screen. Go back and look at places why they were so hung up on this. Because canon evolves. We all know things that were set a certain way. You know, USPA and United Earth Space Probe Agency became Starfleet. And now we try to find the cute reason for what USPA was. I mean, things evolve, and they're so hung up on this. And I love all my Memory Alpha peeps, and I love everybody at Memory Alpha to pieces, but I don't understand why they're so hung up on this when it evolved. So part of cartography was, in certain places, especially the Dominion War section, addressing that on the nose, and not only just saying, not just saying it abruptly, but saying, and there have been some misnomers over the year, and here's how this happened, and, you know. So if nothing else, guys, nothing else, what my contribution to this was above taking Jeff's thing to the format that Becker Mayer and 47 North and CBS came to me with and says, we're going to do these maps and have them be different eras. And here's our suggestions. What do you think? And me kind of basically coming back at them and, you know, and then going. And the guidebook was like going to be an afterthought. Oh, the guidebook was going to be my main thing. And the maps were going to be done by different artists. Well, the different artists wound up being three. And the three became Jeff on the Kitchen Sink National Geographic one at the end, and then Allie and Ian dividing up the other two, the real ones, the modern quote-unquote ones, and the alien quote-unquote ones. And the book was supposed to be my main thing that I got paid 7/8 of my money for. And then toward the end, they were like, can you oversee the maps? I'm like, well, that makes sense, yeah, editorially, because I was wondering how that was going to interface, because they had to match up. And they, I didn't know who was going to make sure everything made sense. The artists are great artists, but none of them was, I mean, Jeff was fine. But Allie and Ian aren't Trek fans to the nth degree. They weren't going to know what to put where and what to call it, you know, and have what the concept would be. Oh, it's the Eve of Organia? Well, then it should be like this on the Klingon map, you know.
I think it's darling that you didn't know who would make sure that it made sense.
No, no. They, we didn't either.
Obviously it would be
they,
you.
No, here's the thing. They came back to me and said, we realize that we need you to like editorially oversee the maps themselves aside from the book, so here's some extra money. And I went, oh, okay, but the maps are what was like, it's like I got 7/8 of the money I got paid was for technically the book, but 7/8 of the time went into the maps, which you look at and you go, well, yeah, duh. But you know, and again, this was like a 3-4 month project, you know, because it had to be, it was for Christmas and it was going to be printed in China. And so it had to be done by May to get back in time for Christmas season, only, you know, to be sold December 6th or whatever the debut day was. So we had like December to March, April, and it stretched out more just because we didn't have as many artists involved as they thought. So the guys, so Allie and Ian were like stacked up, you know. They can only do so much at a time. It wasn't like eight people each doing a map apiece. It was like them doing four and five apiece.
Still
and anyway,
good.
it was just you know, so yeah, so the maps wound up being the lion's share of the time, and I think it kind of got my, you know, bless her heart, Dana, my editor. I made sure that things weren't my, and I hope to God I didn't slow any of the process down at all. But we were just we were you know, dancing as fast as we could, and John at CBS, everything was like looking to me, and there were times when you would legitimately have an idea and go, we can go with this or we can go with this. What should you guys want to do? And they're like, you know, John would say, well, maybe we should. We had two all in the same room meetings, one in Seattle with me with them and then one in L.A. Actually, two in L.A., a kickoff one and then like near the end of the thing. And but a lot of the times it was just up to, okay, Larry, best guess. Which, you know, I knew the two main things were update Enterprise, which mainly was the Zindi, was the Expanse. The Delphic Expanse, and how are we going to handle the prime parts of JJ's movie and, you know, the Hobus, which mainly was the Hobus supernova, and thank God for the comics for giving us some stuff that made sense. And, oh, it's a subspace supernova. Oh, it's a subspace shockwave supernova. Thank you. That's helping a whole lot, you know. And what was the name of the star? Oh, Hobus. That's from the comic, right? So anyway, so and then we thought, well, if we do that, we can't do all the pretty normal Romulan stuff that we know it from. So we made the conceit that this is this was all done, assembled right before. When you live in a world like 24th century, where it's things are holographic and you have digital files, having it be a 2D thing on paper is kind of a odd thing anyway. So we kind of, there was originally a lot more in world. Kind of like with the original tech manual, when they explain it by saying that this is the outgrowth of tomorrow's yesterday, and these were some files downloaded at the Omaha, you know, air base, you know, yeah. McKinley Rocket Base in Assignment Earth, and then the you know, this was some stuff that slipped through then and was leaked out, and the U.S. Air Force is denying it. Oh no, no UFO, no UFO, and that was the cute little entry thing to the original tech manual that may have been lost to time now. But we were trying to come up with that. These are the most requested top 10 maps that people request or they want to view when they come to Memory Alpha and they go through the public wing. But each map has a little story. Yeah, that was totally me coming up with like little homage name, my family and friends. And if you look at the maps, I don't know if anybody even noticed this, but if you look at the little tag, like everything else was supposed to be the way the map was, either as a 2D object like the ancient Vulcan, you know, or whatever, or this is the basic file if you output it to a 2D surface, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why in 2387 you'd want to do that or whatever. But And with the tag, the only thing uniform is here's our little Memory Alpha tag over here in the lower left-hand corner. And when you see that, you know, saying where it came from and kind of like the basic tag of all the people in those things are either kind of like I did on the things I did that are now infamous from the Picard family album about the Romulan War and Battle of Charon. But they're either that or there's a shout-out to Franz Joseph and a shout-out to my friend Kevin who does all my artwork and Legos and things. So I was hoping could do a map, but they just decided to keep it to the two people they'd worked with before. So guys, you know, I know I've talked about this. I guess I haven't talked about the maps with you guys, but
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I know that you did that episode with literary treks and everything like that where a lot of people can find some info. I guess my one question would be, which I think both of us have, you know, because we talked about it a lot on the episode too, but I was thinking about it even while reading it. How much of that stuff did you have to look up when you were writing it, and how much did you know off the top of your head? Because there's a lot of, like, really seemingly obscure Star Trek...
I don't know if a lot is the word. I think you mean all of the information.
It's just, it's so dense, and there's so many things where it's like, what? Oh, yeah, that's... Did he know that? Or did he look that up?
I think we both kind of assumed that you knew it all.
Yeah.
And the only reason you have materials on hand is just to confirm that you were right.
Right. It's like my uncle. He's a reference librarian. And there's lots of times where people will come in and say, I need to know the answer to this. And he's like,
well, I think it was 1862, but I'm going to go look it up for 6 days and then confirm it.
He's like, I know what it is. Now I need to find a source.
Yeah.
You know? I get the impression that's what it was like when you were writing this thing.
Well, that's what... Yeah, that's what doing the concordances, even though I never got the DS9s and Enterprise and Voyagers finished. But that's what doing the concordances and writing, working fact files for 6 years and doing show notes for two or three after that. But a lot of it is getting out of the episodes as episodes and standing back. That's what I always like to do. It's like take these dots and connect them among, you know, within a series and series to series. It's like the other day, I mean, I had gone back and it's what I was doing as I was doing concordance. Like the, I mean, I don't know who else did this, but if you were back in the day after all the talk about what's the dating system, and I don't mean, you know, geek speed dating. I mean the dating system, like all the talk about where was the original series actually? People forget now, but if nothing else, when the neutral zone aired at the end of first season of Next Generation, and you had survived that first season hanging in with the show. And
survived is a good word choice.
Yes. And when you felt like you were being vindicated because, look, this show Allegiance, I mean Conspiracy, and then this, oh my God, it's Romulans, and it's at the neutral zone, and they're talking about the outpost. When Allegiance, the last at the end, and, I keep saying it, Conspiracy and Neutral Zone aired. And the stories were better, and they were actually like all the stuff they ran away from. You know, now we know, but when they ran away from having Romans and Klingons and Vulcans because they didn't want to copy the original series and they wanted to stand alone, you know, and all this stuff in the Ferengi didn't work out, you know, all these different things. But it was like there was a determination made, and maybe it was because Maury Hurley had settled in as the showrunner. Or whatever. I would look at the credits and say, oh, look, this Hannah Louise Shearer and this Tracy Torme, they're new writers in the credits. That must be why the shows are getting better. They've got, you know, it's like they're in the shows because that's what was airing when they've been there for 3 months already. That's just what was airing when they had time to stick their names on the credits at the end. But when those shows came around, they were like, ooh, this is starting to feel like there's some guts here and some meat here. So you're watching already feeling good and feeling like, okay, we're going to come out of this season strong, and I can't wait for the next year. And you're watching coming of age, and Data says when they thaw out the pod people, and they say, "Why? What year is it?" And Data says, "Why? It's the Earth year 2364. I fell off my chair 47 times." It's like they just put the okay. So all the stuff that was in house and secret, but when you'd read the press stuff, they didn't say next gen is 80 years past. You know. The time of Kirk. They would say Next Generation is 78 years past the time of Kirk and Spock. Very precise, you know.
Yeah.
Not 74, but 78. And I go, the first thing I did was go, okay, so 23, 64, minus, okay, 78, that's 28. Okay, that's That's 2286. Okay, or whatever it is. Oh. Oh! The paper in Star Trek IV, when they look at the newsstand, was from the year. And, okay, so 2, 3, and 4 are supposed to be a trilogy. Okay. And my mind was often running, going, but that's what would always, you know. So from then on, the concordance, anytime anybody would say, yes, I was governor of this planet for 8 years ago, I would, if you look at my early concordances, everything would say, or 23 blah, 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 reckoned by NZ. Because I would doing like Bijo did and have a little two-letter abbreviation. Except Bijo's was all capitals and mine for Next Gen were all little letters. So you could tell them apart. Like, who knew there'd be four more series and this would get ridiculous soon. And everybody would start using, you know, like episode numbers and then season episode number. So everything in those first, you know, or they would say, oh, the Charybdis, you know, and up the long letters this year. And blah, blah. Anytime there was any kind of age or date reckoning, I would say, or 23 blah, blah, reckoned by NZ. You know, it would always refer back to that because that was just like the slap in the face for the good. It was like, oh, my God, they finally. Now, a year or two or three later, I go, that's Mike Okuda doing that. Mm-hmm. That's Mike Okuda doing that in-house, keeping things, whether they're paying him. And you look at the end. Oh, technical consultant, Mike Okuda, technical consultant, Rick Sternbach. That's what they're doing besides their art job. They're the fan who's the fly on the wall that they gave a keyboard to. You know, it's like, thank God. And then it was like, that's where all the cool little graphic-y stuff is coming from, the in-house stuff, you know. And so that was like, oh, my God, okay. Someone is actually on the inside trying to fix the wacky stuff that no one thought about or they tried to and didn't realize that would get overwhelming on the original series.
I like to think of him as like a sleeper cell.
Yeah, it's like we have someone on the inside.
Completely. And someday they will say on the side, but there were times when they got called on the carpet at times about it, or just kind of like, really, guys, really? You know, kind of stuff. Yeah. But which, that's a whole, you could do a whole book. So anyway, so when that happened, it was like, yes, yes. So I just started paying attention to that. And anyway, so all the stuff I had written for years had that. So yeah, when I had to do stellar cartography, I'd work with, you know, and I'd work with Jeff, and I wrote the chapter intros, was my main contribution to his book. But everybody was screaming because it's book pages, right? But that's all Pocket was locked into being able to do. Nobody, you know, there were two fold, you know, those fold-outs at the back, which were, oh, this is so out of the box. But even then, there was like a fourth of the whole thing. And since then, people have like scanned those and merged them as a one big digital file, right? And you could see the seams. Except Jeff had printed some of those, and he gave me one of them. So I had, like, that thing all these years up in front. But that's what drove people crazy. And there's no index? No, there's no index. I don't know if you guys noticed this, but one of the big things we tried to do was, at least on the alpha-beta maps, the known space alpha-beta map, we did a letter-number combination key along the sides.
Okay.
Yeah.
With the index, so that you can actually go. It's not horribly detailed, but there's, like, 50 or 60 on each one. When you look in the key down there, it actually says what's Federation or what's not, and then it has like A7, B2, D6, you know, and of course D7, you know. So there's actually a key in there. So you, because what do I do? I want to know something. What? Oh, sorry.
Is D7 the Klingon? D7.
Yeah, I don't think it's in there. I don't think somebody Cannon. What happened? So, because one of the things that got to me was, and here's where I say God bless Memory Alpha, because they actually went through and would note, you'd look up a star and they'd say, well, in the famous chart from Conspiracy, this is alpha in the alpha fighter. But Star Charts says that, you know, Doodleberg's star is in the beta quadrant on page blah blah. And literally, while I was working on this, if I wanted to know, if I'm looking through, because we would make blow ups and things of Jeff's and work from those.
Mm-hmm.
I've got huge. I mean, we actually made like five times bigger things where it's like ridiculous. But we'd take I'd say, here's what we want as a base. Here's your artist reference. Take this, crop it, and then they would. And then I would like handwrite on those big ones. Our first pass was taking those, blowing them up, and I would write a ton of things, and then they would transfer it, and then we would come up with our first approach, right, on the normal ones, and then the alien ones were take it and then put an alien layer and then go from there, but. The first pass was just getting the scale and the scope and what are we framing here? And on paper in huge roll-up tubes that weighed 5 or 6 pounds. And I needed to know where things were, where to go to in the book. And I was going to Memory Alpha to see what page they said it was on to go back and find it if I was in a hurry and it was an obscure store, because there's no index in the damn thing. So one of the things we were doing was trying to give everybody, you know, at least a kind of an index there where it made sense to do. But what was sad was, again, poor Ian, we did that and he did a grid system, right? So it wasn't just here's letters and numbers with like little triangles and you kind of like find your way across. He did hardcore lines. And we're like at the last stage of the thing and I went, wait a minute, these look like sectors. And a sector is 20 by 20, right? Or 10 by 10, right? Or whatever. 10 by 10, yeah. 10 by 10 or 20 by 20? See? I don't know everything off the top of my head. Anyway, in Jeff's system...
Dude, I don't even know what you're talking about, bro.
In Jeff's system, a sector is formally defined as... You can cut this, right?
Sure.
Sector is formally defined as 10 by 10 or 20 by 20. Anyway, my point is, the way Ian had drawn hard lines on this thing, it made them look like they were sectors. And I was like, oh, no. And we were like at the next to last pass. And he'd set the letters and the number. So our letter number key that was our big gift to everybody for sanity's sake was like, oh, no. Everybody's going to go, wait a minute. These sectors are like 7 3/8 by 7 3/8. They're not 10 by 10 light years. And, you know, because there's a scale down here. But they're like, what are you drawing these sectors? And there's a weird number. What are these squares? They don't make. And I was like, oh, guys, we have to, like, change the grid. We have to, like, rejigger the letters and number grid and make these 20. If you're going to draw a hard line, and it's like, I'm not going to do that. Because it would, like, almost like digitally ripping it up and starting over in a way. Or a huge chunk of time. And I'm like, we have to do something.
Now I got to open this thing up and look at it because that doesn't seem like a problem to me.
So we've had people. So we had like a compromise number, and I can't remember now what it was. But it's not. They're not the classic definition of a. You're really like going to make me grab my star charts book and look it up. Anyway, it's on Jeff's chart. It's there, of course, number 10, because that's. Why else would you draw grids on a map if you're not doing sectors and you're not doing, you know?
I mean, XY coordinates, I mean, you got to, I mean, like, no matter what the scale is, you still got to know where you are
like
in it.
A continuous tic-tac-toe board there, they're obviously sectors. They're not, you know. Anyway.
Yeah.
So we came to a compromise number when it was at least a round number. It wasn't like, you know, a fraction or something goofy. But I already saw at least one or two reviews where they said, and what's with the sectors on the alpha and beta quadrants? They're not 10 by 10 sectors or something. And I was like, I know.
Nerds.
It's just one of those weird things that felt, well, but see, you know the story of the prison camp line in DS9 on the Dominion prison camp show, the two-parter.
I think so.
What's the story? What's that?
The story with this is I'm sitting in Janet's office reading the draft for the one where Garak and Worf are kidnapped, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you basically, the Dominion captures them. They wind up on a Dominion prison camp, and you find out that Martok, not Gowron, but it's Martok who was the changeling, mm-hmm. because here's captured Martok here. And I'm reading along, and I go, wait a minute, there's Gowron? I mean, there's Martok and there's Worf. Why have they not tried to kill themselves in captivity? And I just remember I looked up and I said that out loud. And this was a story that who did it? Ira and Wolf and Robert Wolf or Ira and Hans? It was whoever was Ira's writing partner at the time. It wasn't Ron Moore's script. And it was a two-parter. And I looked up and I go, why aren't they trying to kill themselves? And Janet looked over and she says, oh, Larry, stop being such an anal fan. And I went, okay. But it's kind of like bashed you over the head that Klingons would kill themselves if taken prisoner. So 2 or 3 days ago, I go, okay, it's just one more thing where they're going to say they've lost touch with canon. And this is like mid-DS9. So 3 or 4 days later, Janet comes home and goes, Larry, what was the episode that everybody went on and on about Klingons killing? I said, Birthright, 1 and 2, 2 parts. And she's like, okay. So the next day she comes home and he goes, here's 2 Birthright scripts. I just happened to mention, like Ron came in to get his mail, and I happened to mention that about he might want to take a look at the script that Iron were working on.
Oh, boy.
Now, this is not, you know, and he's like, oh, okay. And she says, they have Klingons captured, but they're not trying to kill themselves. And he just kind of like looked at her wide-eyed and went on. But this is how you do things in channels. versus standing up and going, hey, you did that whole two-part show, and you didn't have the Klingons killing themselves. And this is the way it would do. This is why if you have your show staff right, even future TV Star Trek, you can handle this crap, okay? You have your Supreme Court of people helping you. So the next day, Janet comes home and throws me a vanilla envelope. She goes, there's two Birthright scripts. Can you tag every time in Birthright they mention the fact that Klingons kill themselves when they're taken prisoner? I went, okay. So I sat down, and like the little, you know, the little clear tags, you say, sign here, you know, kind of things, post-it things.
Yeah. Act one, act two, act three.
I finished most, well, they're like a quarter inch thick. They're like 60 pages, 70 pages. So I did, and each one has like, you know, 15 tags on it, you know.
Yeah.
So I took those back and, you know, did that. Janet just left that sitting on Ron's little mail slot. It was gone. Two or three days later, she said, here's a new draft on Dia's Cast and whatever it was. You might want to take a, you know, Fire in the Glory, whatever it was called. Darkness in the Light, maybe, whatever. She's like, sorry, everybody. I'm not knowing those episodes. I don't do Star Trek every single day for pay anymore, so sorry. I have to research a little bit. But it's the two-parter DS9 of the Dominion camp, labor camp. So I come home, and all they had to do was to have Garak, which makes total sense, go, hey, wait a minute. I thought Klingons killed themselves when they're taken in captivity. And Worf and Martok each have a line, and they look at him. And one of them says, not when there's still hope of escape. And he says, and not when there are still battles to be fought. And that's all it took. Now think how much fanboy grief was say. And, you know, you can say, oh, anal fans. But if they did not, if Gene and Dorothy and Gene didn't start trying, and Bob Justman didn't start trying to do that, and failing at times in the overwhelm, but if they didn't try to start doing that on the original series, would any of us be sitting here doing this right now?
Well, no, and that's what we love about it, and you know that's what you know the it's so great about like the encyclopedia and everything. And everyone has their little thing. Like even I mean, we were just talking about how Chris made a new logo for our show, and it's the most amazing logo I've ever seen. He obviously gave us the best logo out of all the shows. But it's got a film strip with some numbers on it.
Okay, and I am not happy about this. This is the thing.
Being projectionists, both Max and I looked at it and we're like, the numbers are upside down. And we're like, hey, Chris, how hard would it be to change this? And he's like, it would be really freaking hard. It's not happening. So, yeah, I mean, that type of thing happens. So I totally understand why your sector numbers are a big deal, you know.
I'll be honest. I saw it. I knew something was wrong. I didn't want to know. I felt
it wasn't
with
like
myself.
Take the lines out and redraw them. If you did that, it means then we'd have to like rejigger the letters across the top wouldn't go A through S. They'd go A through K, which means we'd have to come back and put new little index numbers at the back of. See what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm,
it's like if you made the grids to what you know, 10 by 10 or 20 by. I think it's 20 by 20. He said, jumping off a cliff, which would make more sense. It would be a bigger square. So if you rejiggered this grid to 20 by 20, you would have to redo the numbers in the letter key, and then you would have to come back to all those 60 stars and double-check and make sure you'd gotten a new thing for them, you know.
Yeah.
So it was like a three-step process you'd have to do. And we were like, you know, this was already, September, and we were supposed to be done by May or something. So.
Okay, so I've got like, an idea. For your next book, here's what you do. If it's in-universe... just have one of your researchers be credited as Q so that any errors can be corrected by him by making them fact.
Okay. Just do a finger snap. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then we did the whole thing, and then, since we had used Jeffs as a starter, and I always want to say that, you know, that wrote the book. We didn't have to reinvent the wheel as far as where things were. We had to add all the new stuff. There were some things to fix, and there's one thing that Jeff got wrong because they goofed up Dominion War. AR-558, when Doug or Mike River did those big wall charts they would have on the – they have like AR-558 was supposed to be within the Chintaka system, and there's two or three maps where it's like, oh, it's out here beyond Antares. No, it's out here beyond the Ferengis or something. There's one map where there's like two different things on one map. So Jeff has two different AR-558s on this map, and it's kind of like anybody else that's looking at it going, well, duh, this is hard. This is really rocket science. You've got two of the same thing here. So we fixed it, and, you know, we did some things there, and there was a lot of things that could be adjusted and stuff. But the Dominion War geography in particular, and if nothing else, this is where I don't know if it just hasn't got down to that level of nerddom and analness or whatever, but because DS9 is now in a rebirth, and there's tons more fans of DS9 now than there ever were, so maybe this will come to pass. But of all the parts of the book, and thank you for saying the book was dense, because I think people tend to look at it and go, these maps are gorgeous, and what's this dinky little kid's book over here for? Because they look at it, and it's like, well, is this a little Engine That Could book? Is this, you know, what is this? Why is this thing a core? Why did you bother to put this in here, much less put it in hardback? You know, kind of a thing.
It doesn't but read dense. It just has tons of data.
Tons of data in it. Yeah, thank you for
it.
It flows.
It flows. But
I wrote
like, as
that
a nerd,
insanely.
It's like, how does he know this?
Well, the maps wound up squeezing, like expanding in time so much that they squeezed. It's like at one point, it's like, I really am going to sit down and start writing the book. And on one hand, it's like, look, it's like two, three, it's like so many hundred words per chart. It's not that many words. But all I did was just sit down and write what needed to be said about that one. And some of them, it was about that. Some of them, it was like twice as much material as ought to be there. But the bottom line was that I was writing it like just sit down, and we were up against the deadline now. Because part of me knew that, learned the lesson on the companion, the maps, it's a map set, so people are going to focus on the maps. People are going to love or hate the maps. The maps are what's going to be the selling point of this. It's what's cool. It's what's out of the box. It's why Becker Mayer was doing it for Amazon. It's not just another book. That said, I knew in my heart of hearts that the book would still be on people's shelves and would and be there. But the maps stole the lion's share of the time when I got 7/8 of what I was technically paid for was the book. But when I got the book, I had to do it, and it was like, I thought I was under the gun for the companions and things. that was insane, and the chapters that, and some of it was like, I'm just writing, I got into the right voice, and I'm just going. And here it is, and we'll cut it down. And I hated to do this, to dump on poor Dana about, because she knew Star Trek, and she had learned working on David Goodman's The Federation 150 Years book. Mm. But she, you know, They turned it over and had Paula Block, who was still doing freelance on the novels. Paula did a severe edit where it needed, because each one was a new section, so one could be okay and the next one could be severely needed, whatever. And she did a wonderful pass through. At the time, I was like, oh Jesus Christ, I'm so insignificant and horrible person because I'm not edited. I should have done this myself, but the time was ticking, and I should have done it right the first. And the maps are what was going to be in everybody's face and had the attention, and that's what was like soaking up time. And somewhere along the way, at the very 11th hour, I kept finding these stars that weren't in Jeff's book after I would track down what the coordinate was finally on Memory Alpha, because there's no index. And I kept saying, where's the Doomsday Machine in L374 and L370? Okay. You know, what? And it's like, I don't see it on your original stuff. I've found a place that makes sense. Okay, because it's not tied into anything. And where's the space-going amoeba with Gamma 7A? Because they do mention the Mallurian system, and the Mallurian system has got a real, has a real tie in real astronomy. Oh, yeah, put that in. Okay. You know, and at some point, all kinds of stuff.
At some point, was someone like, someone must have deleted the star from the Jedi archives?
Well, part of what it was is...
No?
Well, some of what it was his original thing he did. He had everything. But if it was like off the grid and it didn't wind up on an inset mat, it got left out. Mm-hmm. Which is what I found out later on when somebody wrote me. When they first came out, somebody said, somebody who's a huge piece of the action fan goes, Larry, where's Sigma Iosha and the Iotians? You know, that obscure show called Piece of the Action? And I'm like, oh, it's right. Wait. Oh, shit. We left it off. Where did Jeff have it? Oh, shit, Jeff left it off, too. And that's a fun show. And I started, so I went to the end of the show, and I started going back. There are like three-fourths of the third season. And when I say the third season, you can tell I'm using capital letters, so I mean the original series, because that's how we talked about it for 20 years. Like three-fourths of the original season stars aren't on my maps because Jeff didn't have them. Because we were taking the charts and going from it. And I'm like, really, guys? Really? I mean, unless it was an astronomical thing or had been mentioned already from an earlier thing. I was like, really? I mean, that just kills me. So so I came out right up front and I said, guys, please help me start a list of what's not here. So when we do the next one, we'll get them in. So I tried to turn it around and say, you know, I should start a website. I should do. That's what Mike and Denise did with the encyclopedia. I mean, something this dense and huge and thick, you're bound to have that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
There should be.
I just hate it. There's like an easily definable block of there's a lot. I started going backing up, you know, through all the late shows. Camus too. Oh, Camus is in there because some of it's like the Turnabout Intruder stuff is in there because Beta Aurigae is a real star, and so all those things got located kind of quasi close in. But the things from yesterday, from All Our Yesterdays, Sandara, and some of those things, and I started backing up to the third season. Oh, they're not here. Okay, well, we'll get them next time. We'll get them next time, guys. I'm sorry, we got the fucking Zindi Expanse, Delphic Expanse in there figured out, you know? That it made no sense the way they described it being 2,000 light years long and in between Earth and... I'm sorry, what are we, like in hour 92 here, hour 47?
Well, I think probably what we'll end up doing is splitting this up into a two-parter. We're gonna best of both worlds this thing, but...
I forgot to say Mr. Worf Fire. Okay.
That's okay, we can add it in post. Stellar Cartography, it seems pretty well covered. Is there anything else on Stellar Cartography that you want to...
Just that I appreciate... I'm hoping maybe now that the pretty maps have gotten everything, as they should.
Yeah.
Again, that same vein of one of the discovery things about this when we were trying to have different artists do the maps was I thought, well, let's look out in fandom and see what great, you know, fandom or semi-professional artists are out there and gave them a shot here. And I went looking and I was, and especially, I thought, well, there'll be a dime a dozen Klingons because Klingon fandom is so huge. But let's find those obscure Romulan and Kardec, because this is the era of the internet and everything, and this stuff is 20 years old and 30 years old, and everybody's out there. And I started looking online anyway, and I couldn't find anybody. So one of the things, aside from, hey, send me the star that's either we need to fix or is not there, is I just want to start getting a Rolodex. That's a term from the 70s, guys. I just want to start getting a database of fan artists who like are culture fans. Mm-hmm. Who they're really like a big Cardassian fan and they're an artist, or they're a big Romulan fan and they're an artist, because they ran into this with the with David's Federation 150 book. I found that in hindsight, you go back and look at the when they would try to do the graphics, there's no like reference graphics. I mean, at the 11th hour we were doing the Romulan map, and I'm like, there's no Romulan iconography, and then like at the 11th hour I was like, Allie, the carpet map. And they're like, everybody's like, what? And then John's like, oh, the carpet map. In that, you know, every Star Trek, no matter how much somebody may hate it, hey, and the children shall lead, has the Federation pennant.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's like, go. Oh, Nemesis, the Romulan Senate floor carpet. With the you have a Romulan map on the floor that Rick Sternbach did. So we went to that. I went back and got my file that Rick had given me in, you know, 02 or whatever. And I'm like, look, they've got one icon for star bases and one for stars, and they've got a different one for the Federation and a different one for their homes. Yay! We've got Romulan map iconography from Rick's carpet from 02. So they were like, oh, this is cool! And it looked like nothing else, and nobody, you know. So we had little victories like that. But that's the way it was, only it was like a compressed time frame and stuff. But my bottom line there was, I was just shocked to figure out that there weren't Facebook groups of Romulan artists and Cardassian artists and Vulcan, ancient Vulcan artists. Especially Vulcan.
Yeah,
you know, from
that.
the '70s. I would have thought there'd been a ton, and I bet there were probably more in the '70s, and they've all the women have died off by now. But you know, so I was disappointed that I hate to say this, but I'm again, it's like you're talking about the creator is the one that's the most aggrieved and everybody else loves it, and you hate to even put this out there. But I really And Allie and Ian did, you know, amazing jobs. And the Vulcan map really is out there. It really is alien-ish looking and trying to figure out what way to go. But I guess I was really surprised that I wish we could have found people who did that in Cardassian stuff. And, of course, Cardassian probably is the thing we have the most graphic images of because we have DS9s. But we could have pushed the envelope or found things that existed and incorporated them and maybe even employed somebody. But incorporated those things out there and built and kept this merging, which, you know, Jeff's original fan maps. Some people had done some groundwork research into how things would fit together, given the basic quadrant map, and that the Klingons and Romulans are over here, and the Cardassians and Bajorans are over here. And given that, some of the fans that had done things online that he took from and then added a whole new layer to and then and credited them. And that's kind of what we're doing. It's Jeff's and all those people's thing, and then we've introduced all these different from the standpoint of times in history and alien viewpoints and, you know, alien personality and whatever. So that's what this brought to it. And then what I knew in my heart would be is, well, if you're writing about all these maps, you're not just saying, you know, it's in-universe. So what you're talking about, the book being dense, is here's my chance over 10, 15, 20 years of all the things that would pop up when I would answer a question in the Titan, you know, my little column in Titan magazine, or there'd be some fan debate, and I would come up with a canon massage that would make everybody happy. You know, my list of 14 or 15,000 of those that are like little stray things, here's a chance in a lot of ways to pull them all together and put them down in one place. Led by, number one, what the hell was the big thing with the Dominion War? Why was Earth and Vulcan always under threat when everything is happening way over here, you know, by Cardassia and the wormhole? And I'd come up with reasons for that. And then when I got into it and realized, oh, the Battle of Tyra was this huge honking early defeat, and we don't know where the hell it was, except it took them a week or two to limp back to DS9. And I kept staring at the stupid layout of everything, and Cardassia and the Tholians started looking like North and South America, and the Klingon Empire is like the upper horn of North Africa, and here's the homeworlds, and the Romulans are like Russia behind Europe. And it was just kind of like weird, and here's the Ferengi hanging over here like Iceland. And I was like, oh, and it's like it all starts going to World War II on me, and I'm thinking across the Atlantic, and on the convoys coming over from the Klingons or leaving Casablanca. And anyway, it's just some of the answers I came up with. My mind drifted because I was a big map geek and back map freak, and I love World War II and 20th century history. So, and this is what I was kidding with Chris about you know, oh, here's the north, you know, the jet stream coming up north, but this whole thing about there was a northern front that we didn't get in on, and why, you know, Betazoid was occupied, but so was one of the B planets, either Bolius or the smoke breathers,
Breen.
No, not the Breen. They were with coming of age, and they brought him back, Mordok, yeah. And Morlock.
Oh,
or whatever.
Fish guy.
Yeah, one of those.
They're blue skinned.
Yeah,
I've got anyway. B word. The Byzantines, no. Anyway, one of them was occupied, and it's like, and they're close to the homeworlds, and it's like, well, what was this about? And anyway, so what I really am proudest of in this whole thing, I think, you're talking about connecting dots. There was nowhere the dot connecting happened as it did in the Dominion War, and so even Doug and Mike, as they did the shows, were faking, because the writers weren't. They were just telling their stories, and they're kind of like going, cross fingers, and we'll just kind of put this big splashy map on the wall. And, of course, fanboy me, I wanted to take that map and use that as the basis for canon. And then when you start realizing that, oh, you've stuck a star on here that's way down below the – this is down by Tholia, and we all know it. It's like in a canon point. This is down by you know, gamma – you know, the Wrath of Khan stars. And it's like, okay, well, let's make all of this work. Let's do the story the way it has to fit the grid, but we won't call – Doug and Maps liars and, you know, goofy things, because these aren't literal maps. These are maps showing places where these troops are, you know, they have the big ones with the arrows, like the World War II battle maps would be.
Yeah.
They're not coming from that literal place. These stars are like stars that factor into the movement. Like, that's where this fleet originated, or, you know. So they're on that map for a reason, but it's not a literal, this is 2 light years over on this grid kind of thing. So once I did that, so I've let the – and that's what Jeff did. Jeff's section on the Dominion War, he just slapped 4 of those charts in and went, okay, this is too big a mess for me to figure out right now. I'll just – how can you argue against the stuff that was on screen? Bang. And it still didn't solve the problem. So it was like, okay, we're going to make sense of this, guys. And the Northern Front and Tyra being up in the North Atlantic – and that's where all that happened, and they, you know, and so that's why they pushed on beyond. The Dominion was able to push on beyond and occupy and threaten all those northern homeworld planets, and the other ones. I use the Iraq War, the Persian Gulf War, when they said the way, you know, they fortified the line at Kuwait and the southern border. But what they really – and they thought that was where the big mother of all battles would be, and Saddam had all these guys down there. But all they did was run out the edge pivot, and they were on the big naked exposed – it's kind of like if you're playing Risk and somebody – you break through your guy's barrier, then you've got the big naked place where they moved all their armies up to the border at Risk. Yeah. And you make the big pivot, and oh, look, it's like open field running. It's like Hitler running across the Ukraine, you know, the steppes of Russia before he got bogged down at Moscow and Leningrad. And Stanislavski and Stalingrad. It's like that big open area. So it's like if the Dominion can break through down here in the past Beta Z in that area, then they've got open field running to get to the home world. So it wasn't about they're right there on their doorstep. It's like they're on the doorstep over here. But if they ever break through this wall where, you know, Chintaka and all that was, if they can break through that wall, then there's nothing to stop them getting over to Earth and Vulcan. And those three little Mars perimeter ships you saw in Best of Both Worlds ain't going to do it.
I suppose not.
Yeah.
I like that. It's a very soft, under-the-covers retcon.
So yeah. Some of the stuff was stuff I'd come up with a long time ago. Some of the stuff was you sitting there with the thing in front of you going, oh, well, this makes sense. Because you had to explain it. That's what always got me was like, why? You know, but then... And the other thing about the whole alpha beta powers thing. All you have to say is the alpha quadrant powers was a Dominion phrase.
Mm-hmm.
Just like in World War II, you would talk about, you know, the West. Well, Russia was fighting with us, and I don't think anybody would call Russia the West. They're not the East. They're like,
yeah.
They're not the Mideast. But anyway, they're the Slavic countries. People don't think of them as being West, but Russia got the Soviet Union got lumped in with the U.S. and Britain as the allies against Germany and.
Yeah, it's perfectly reasonable, short.
Yeah. So yeah. I go through – so some of the stuff in the – so if nothing else in the book – I know you guys are just flabbergasted apparently, but a lot of those things are just things that I've just had in my back pocket for years working on all the projects, and a lot of it – I mean I would go like look up a specific date to tie it down or whatever, but a lot of it was just the way I had kind of thought about things.
Yeah.
But the Dominion War section especially is where I feel like I got to – if I had any – if I died tomorrow, my big contribution to Star Trek – was going to be my chapter on the Dominion War.
Well, hey, you know, I mean, if there's a piece of Star Trek history which is worthy of contribution, it's the Dominion War. I mean, that's a pretty epic piece of the puzzle.
And if there's a piece that's not worthy, it's the Doomsday Machine.
Okay, I think you're going to upset a lot of original series fans with that one. But
the geography of that episode makes no sense.
Oh, they fixed. Did you see the remastered?
No, but did they?
Wait, you
fix
mean the
geography
of the battle? What do you mean?
Did they
what do you
fix
mean
the
with the
dialogue
geography?
in the episode where like they keep saying galaxy when they mean solar system?
Oh. Don't, it's the six, don't. I thought you were talking about the, no, when they did the remastered, they completely made the, it's okay to watch it, but they totally choreographed the actual battle of the two ships and the Doomsday Machine.
That's not the problem I have.
Pivoting, okay, I get that now. What are you going to do, Kirk? That thing's on the way to the heart of our galaxy. What are you going to do about it? Well, let it go there, because it'll get burned up in the big fireball at the beginning. At the center of the,
I think
is that what you're talking about?
Next episode, maybe. That's what I think I'll do.
So okay, no, I don't know. Don't. I don't know if this is
that was said by a man who was traumatized and in shock.
Yeah.
See, there's an explanation for it.
And you I could... said I don't like this episode because I was traumatized and in shock.
You're the only one. Can't say that, Max.
Yeah, that's one of my two favorite shows, guys, from the original series. Wow. Okay. Wow.
So before this gets any.
The Constellation Dirge is one of the best pieces of music ever from the original series. Okay.
Well, before Max makes Larry cry, Larry, I don't know if you can answer this question.
He did, but not anymore. Oh, I'm sorry. I just can't stop riffing on. Okay.
Are there any other books on the horizon? Is there anything that you're working on? Whether you can talk about it or not.
Yeah, no, not at the minute. I'm afraid that we may have had the brakes put on our great nonfiction comeback with the Fed 150 book and this. Amazon decided they were going to back on, not just these Star Trek ones, but across the board, the Star Wars and all the other non-genre things. These out of the box, cool presentational things. Amazon is apparently backing out of doing that because they realized even though it was pretty digital and pretty light footprinted, they still wind up with warehouses full of organic things made from trees and carbon debris. Mm-hmm. So they're slacking back on, they're cutting back on these kind of projects. So the great nonfiction boom maybe at least curtailed for now, whatever. I don't know about some of the other publishers. So at the moment, no. At the moment, we're in this wacky world of go do your own stuff and entrepreneur yourself and go brand yourself. And technology changes every 4.7 minutes, so there's that too. So so no, to answer your question directly, no. But that doesn't mean that something might not come up. The other thing that's driving that, though, is the 50th anniversary is coming up.
That's true.
And there are people screaming that we've got to have special stuff, cool stuff for the 50th anniversary, or we should all just, you know, shoot ourselves and then jump out an airlock. So,
so what else do you have coming up? You're going to FedCon this week, is that right?
This is partly because of Stellar Cartography and partly because of Star Trek Continues. This has turned into a huge convention year for me. So, yeah, FedCon in Germany for the first time in like 10 years. And then Phoenix Comic Con is right after that, first weekend in June. And we're going to do some continued screening there, but also no premieres or whatever. They're having the world premiere of Episode 3, which I'm not in, but it's going to be June 15th, and it'll be online. So for all the Continues fans there. Convention-wise, then it's little Bayou Con in Lake Charles, Louisiana, which is a hoot, at the end of the month, third weekend. And then the last weekend of June is my homies back in Oklahoma City with SoonerCon, which is growing every year now. And then we've got 2 days at Comic-Con San Diego, because this year, with Vegas Trek right after that, we're doing the tour this year, our Trek to Vegas, LA to Vegas Trek film site tour again, the second edition, and going to Valley of Fire, and which is where Kirk died in Generations. So if we still get, I think June 10th is the deadline, so people can still jump in on the big tour with a deposit and get in touch on geeknationtours.com and all that. But we're offering a 1 day if you're coming to the Vegas Trek Con and you're there Wednesday before things start on Thursday. Early morning Wednesday, we're letting people come in as a day trip and jump in with the full tour as we all go out to the Valley of Fire about an hour away and go. The bridge that Kirk died on was donated to the park, and it's actually on a trail. We can go do there and see it and do photo ops and then go over to the film site where they did the rocket launcher and the final fight and Kirk's grave and all that stuff is in one basic place. And it'll be hot, but we'll be ready for it. And it's incredible scenery, like everything else on the tour. It's incredible for what it is, much less its Trek piece in Trek history. And the park itself, this one is incredible scenery, as you know, and there's a lot of petroglyphs and Native American pieces there, ancient peoples. So we're going to stop by the visitor center and see that too and get out of the heat too. So that's cool. That's coming up. And then there's an amazing thing I'm going to get to do as an event in the fall that I can't talk about yet, but hopefully that'll come soon. And we're going to debut another Trekland on speaker at Vegas. And I'll just tell you guys that our number two was all about All Good Things on its 20th anniversary. And our fall one, I'm torn between either doing a 15th anniversary thing on What You Leave Behind, the DS9 finale, or do a 20th anniversary, the startup of Voyager, and doing Caretaker.
The first one.
And of course, we're talking about pulling, you know, Michael and Jerry and, you know, Dan Currier, Mike Westmore, 15-20 minute chunk of them talking about it. You know, with the other one, it would be Ira and Ron and those guys. That's okay.
Well, that was definitely fun talking to Larry about Stellar Cartography and the rest of his career. But that's not the only thing we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. Here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And we go to the theater. I still remember this, even though I was only 4. I still remember this. We go to the theater and we're watching it, and then that Klingon dog shows up on screen, and I'm like, what the frack is that? Get me out of here right now.
Earl Grey.
He would have excellent bedside manner. Here is a joke I know.
Would you like a Sumerian sunset? It is pretty. It will lift you from your terminal case of gout.
Choo!
The Ready Room.
I think that she is picturing him in the au naturel division of synchronized swimming.
Captain Fine.
Which is not an Olympic sport, but they are considering it as a demonstration sport for the Rio de Janeiro Games coming up.
The orb.
Is it this thing like where women like bad boys or something? Does Descartes have a Harley that I don't know about?
I think he must. And, I don't know. You know, he rides around on a Harley. He's just breaking hearts all over the place.
To the journey!
He says, yeah, they want me to read. They're saying it's mine if I want it, but I don't want to do it. And she, like, jumps out of her chair and, like, shakes him. She's like, what? Are you kidding? This is Star Trek! Are you kidding? You would be made for life!
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Yeah. I thought you were going to do a Brandon Braga voice.
It's really hard to do a Brandon Braga voice.
That's pretty good.
It's
right got to
be, you know, it's got to be kind of quiet.
Literary Treks.
Again, it was originally published as a scroll form and then later as a codex book, and now both in print and electronic form in the 24th century. And this particular edition of it has an introduction, an afterword, and modern commentary by a 24th century Klingon novelist named Karatak.
Continuing mission.
Goal was to try to get as much Trek content into people's hands and to let people explore the Trek universe with their own spaceship and build their own crew in the way they want, customize and design, and just, you know, to be in your own Star Trek world.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows to get in on the daily Trek Talk. We have new shows for you every day, and you'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, Spreaker. You can download them right from our website. Just go to trek.fm. Or, you know, probably the easiest thing to do, go to itunes.com/trekfm, and you'll see a whole big page right there on iTunes with all of our shows, and it's really cool. Also, if you happen to be downloading this episode the day we release it, which is Friday, June 6th, the next day, Saturday, June 7th, there's going to be a Star Trek convention in Chicago. And I myself will actually be there. So if you are going to be there as well, say hi. Hit me up on Twitter at Mumbles3K and let me know you're going to be there, and I'll stop by and say hi. Or if you just see me walking the floor, say hi. I will be wearing a pink White Sox cap. Probably the only person at the con who is going to be wearing a pink White Sox cap. For those of you who are unaware, the White Sox wear their pink caps when they're animated, kind of like Tribbles. Anyway, before we go, we'd also like to ask you to please support our sponsor, who makes it possible for us to bring commentary, Trek Stars, and our other shows to you each week. Our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. You can get a ton of books for free on Audible. You know, there's one book that Larry wrote that we didn't cover on the show because it was released in the UK and all that stuff, but he talks about it, and that's his making of Star Trek First Contact. And while Larry's book is not on Audible, Audible does have the adaptation of First Contact, which you can get for free since you're a listener on Trek FM. It's written by J.M. Dillard and narrated by Gates McFadden. It's 3 hours and 4 minutes long, and here's the description for those of you not familiar with the movie. Resistance is futile. The greatest threat the Federation has ever faced is the half-organic, half-mechanical Borg. Now more dangerous than ever, the Borg threatens the Federation's past, present, and future. Read by Gates McFadden, Beverly Crusher on Star Trek The Next Generation. And like I said, you can get this book for free on Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from and new titles coming every week. From classics to current bestsellers, Audible has something for everyone. As a Trek.fm listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. So give it a try today. Catch up on all those classic books you've yet to read, or that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank you and Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and Trek.fm. As always, you can find us right here on Trek.fm, where we do Commentary, Trek Stars, or you can also find me on Trek.fm, where I do Standard Orbit, along with Drew, where we talk about the original series. You can also find both Max and myself on our own website, CommentaryTrackStars.com. Also, you know, hit us up on Twitter, @ComTrackStars. Let us know what you think. Let us know what you think about Larry. Or send us an email at ComTrackStars@gmail.com. All right, well, that's it for our look at Larry Nemechek. We would like to thank Larry for joining us, and it was really fun and informative. Hope you all enjoyed it. And we will be back next week to talk about a fictional Star Trek creator, Benny Russell.